first case for argument this morning is Bertrand against Merrim. Mr. Farley.
Thank you. This is really a simple case. Illinois has voluntarily chosen to participate in the federal Medicaid waiver program, allowing developmentally disabled persons to receive services in the community and avoid institutions. Illinois can limit the size of the program and control their costs. Illinois informs the federal agency, CMS, what services will be included in the waiver program. Illinois does not have to offer all services that theoretically could be available, and they don't offer. They don't offer homemaker, home health aid service, personal care services. What they do offer is residential habilitation. 2002, the plaintiff Frank Patterson was found eligible and enrolled in the Medicaid waiver program. In 2003, when he needed 24-hour SILA residential services, which are offered in the program, he was denied funding by the state. And this practice is contrary to federal law. First, CMS never approved the waiver plan with Illinois that limits residential services to only persons who satisfy priorities.
The serious questions here about both subject matter jurisdiction with respect to Mr. Bertrand and the existence of a private right of action. I think you might want to discuss those issues, which are antecedent to your argument on the merits.
Well, we have two plaintiffs. One is Plaintiff Bertrand, who we claim that although he has received services after the filing of a lawsuit, that he still would have a right to be a class representative.
But there's no certified class. That's the problem. If the district court had certified a class, then under cases like Indianapolis against Jacobs, somebody like Bertrand might be properly here, but no class was ever certified. We just have an individual action.
Well, I think it was the Kiefer case in the Seventh Circuit where there was a pending motion to certify a class. A pending motion had been made, and it hadn't been ruled upon.
Did that case deal with a situation where no class was ever certified in the district court?
I can't recall.
I think the answer is no. And I've looked and can't find any case where the court has said, well, just ignore the mootness because somebody moved for class certification, even though no class was ever certified. Now, that may be wrong. Are there some cases like that out there?
I'm not sure, but nevertheless, Plaintiff Patterson was denied the services and would be an appropriate class representative.
Well, we can't talk about class representatives because there's no class. There's just Patterson. You have not appealed, so far as I can see, from the order denying class certification.
There was no order entered. The judge, district court, found the matter to be moot.
Yeah, and well, that's an order denying class certification. You asked for class certification. The district judge said you're not going to get it.
And we asked the court to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment and also reverse the finding that it was moot and remand it back to the district court to address the class certification.
Sorry, have I misunderstood your brief? I look for such an argument in your brief addressing the class certification question. Maybe I just didn't find it properly.
In terms of the private right of action, the plaintiffs have a right to be furnished funding with reasonable promptness to all eligible individuals. Mr. Patterson is an eligible individual in this case. The CMS never approved a waiver plan that limits residential services. The four corners contained in the waiver plan says that the state will give service priority to certain persons, but it never says that they will be excluded. Service priority reflects with order and reasonable promptness. There was nothing submitted by the defendants to CMS said that they would deny funding unless you satisfy the priority population. Additionally, the states claim that they can limit residential services only to those in the priority population is 100% inconsistent with the CMS letter that was sent to the state Medicaid director.
Going back now to the merits, we still haven't discussed the private right of action.
The plaintiffs have a private right of action for, under reasonable promptness, a Medicaid provision. That right is enforceable, and in the Brueggemann case before the Seventh Circuit.
Let me, look, counsel, let me tell you why my, Brueggemann didn't discuss this. We need to now. Let me tell you what my problem is. It looks to me like you're fundamentally making a challenge to the decision of the federal agency to approve the state plan. But the federal agency is an empty chair. It's not here. We don't know why it approved the state plan or what its rules are. This litigation is a challenge by proxy to the federal agency's decision. And normally what the sensible way to proceed, seems to me, is to bring a challenge under the Administrative Procedure Act to the federal agency's decision. Then we don't have an empty chair problem. We have the real decision maker defending its decision. By trying to sue under 1983, we end up with this procedural mess where we don't have the decision maker, and the person being challenged defends by saying, ah, yes, but our plan was approved by the federal agency.
We are not challenging the approval of the plan by CMS. We are challenging the way Illinois administers that plan, which is different. Illinois.
Right, look, the criteria you're complaining about were presented to the agency, and they're part of the agency's approval. Are you arguing that the plan being implemented is different from the one approved, that they hoodwinked the federal agency in some way?
Yes. I am saying that the plan as approved talks about priority, and I have no problem in concept with that. But as administered by the state.
Right. So you think we have a dispute about the state's brief asserts that everything you're challenging was disclosed up front and center to the federal agency and approved by it. So does this case now boil down to your claim that that's false, that you're willing to accept that the plan as presented to the federal agency is valid, and you're now just saying that the state is not administering the plan as presented to the agency?
Yes. The state, when they sent for the renewal, they told CMS, we're requesting a few minor changes to the originally approved waiver. We have also clarified some language to be consistent with current practice. And all they said was, we clarified the waiver eligibility criteria to include the priority population language the state has used during the waiver, and this language was taken from their fiscal year 03 contract governing providers. So they have a contract with providers that say
yes,
certain people have a need for service.
Were the criteria, this population priority criteria, disclosed to the federal agency at the time?
Yes. What I'm saying is...
So now I'm lost. If it was disclosed to the federal agency and approved, and you now say that you're not challenging the approval, that whatever was presented to and approved by the federal agency is valid, then what's left of your claim?
Because priority doesn't mean that you can exclude. CMS told the state in 2001, which their letter warrants respectful consideration due to their specialized expertise, that you cannot develop separate and distinct service packages for waiver population subgroups within the waiver. And this is precisely how Illinois is administering it. They're saying, even though you're enrolled in the waiver, you cannot get services unless you satisfy the priority. We are limiting it to it. There is nothing that says people are to be limited. In fact, the CMS letter to the state said there's no authority under law or regulation to oppose a cap on the number of people who may use the waiver that's lower than the total number. Illinois has imposed a de facto cap by saying we are only going to give services for people who are in this priority. And then CMS told the states, denial of a needed and covered service within a waiver, which is the residential, will convert a feasible service into one that arbitrarily benefits some waiver participants who may have an equal or greater need. And that is precisely what's happening. The CMS approved Illinois. There's nothing that says the priority will exclude people for a residential habilitation.
Has this argument ever been made to HHS? That is, have you sent a letter to the Department of Health and Human Services saying, you know, the state isn't carrying out the plan you approve. Please cut off federal funds.
No, I haven't.
Has anybody?
I don't know.
Because the argument as you're now making it gives us back the empty chair problem. Right? You're now saying the problem in this case is that HHS was deceived and they would have done something different had they known more. And of course, the state is denying that. But then it's hard to know what they would have thought, isn't it?
The state has never submitted documentation to CMS that says that we are going to limit and exclude people unless they satisfy the priority population. And CMS told the states that they can limit the number of people who can enroll in the waiver services and have reasonable methods to control their overall spending, but the states should be able to manage their waiver budgets without undermining the waiver purpose by exceptional restrictions applied to services. The state plan is administered. Illinois has said we are going to deny services unless you fall within the priority. And that is contrary to the purpose of the waiver. It's contrary to the CMS letter sent to the state Medicaid directors. And CMS told the state Medicaid directors that the answers to the questions which they addressed in that letter were derived from Medicaid law.
Mr. Welsh, is it accurate to say that Illinois informed HHS of its changing the waiver program to include the set of priorities? Didn't they do that in 02?
They informed that specifically that they were clarifying the waiver eligibility to include the priority population language that the state has used during the waiver.
And is it your position that that was an inappropriate action, that they couldn't have done that?
No, I'm saying is CMS has recognized that for a reasonable promptness, if someone has an immediate need, then they should get services immediately. For other people, it require more time. Illinois has said we are prioritizing certain people, so for purposes of reasonable promptness, if someone has a crisis, do them now. But the person who's still in the program, who's still eligible, who's still entitled to those level of services, they still are entitled to receive services with reasonable promptness. So they may have to wait that after the person who has an immediate need, but at some point, the reasonableness becomes...
Now this is a program with a limited number of slots, right?
Yes.
That's part of the idea of the waiver. And in your view, what happens if somebody who's not on the priority criteria is receiving services, the number of slots has been used up, and a priority applicant appears? Can the non-priority person be kicked out?
The waiver is full. The priority is full. And can someone be kicked out?
No, look. You are on a priority list if condition X holds.
Yes.
Right? There are 100 slots. On your view, if 99 people of whom X holds appear, they all have to be given services. Number 100, who doesn't have condition X, also has to be given services. And now somebody with condition X appears. Can the non-X person be kicked out of the program in order to accommodate the 100th X person?
If the non-X person was already enrolled in the waiver, then he cannot be kicked out.
One isn't enrolled in a waiver. One is enrolled in a program. The waiver is what HHS gives. Well, I'm confused throughout by this odd language in the briefs. But
if he has been found eligible and he is participating in the waiver program and is receiving some services, he cannot be kicked out because there's somebody else.
That's the problem, then. If you've got a limited number of slots, the only way of making sure a slot is available for somebody who really needs the services is to leave some slots unfilled. But your argument appears to be that it is illegal to leave a single slot unfilled. And that would mean, of course, that the people who really need the services then will appear and not be able to get them.
But there's two arguments. One is that if you have 10,000 persons that can be served, those people who are already in the waiver are entitled to access those services in the waiver.
I wish you would say they are in the program. The waiver is what HHS gives.
They're in the
program is what they're enrolled in.
They're in the program. If they were out of the program, which is not this case, and there were open slots, then a person would be entitled to get into the program if there is a need for an intermediate care facility level of care, and they demonstrate a need for that. But the CMS has told the states that you cannot cap a specific service. So if there's 10,000 people in the waiver program, then conceivably up to 10,000 people in the program would be eligible for residential services if they had a need.
Well, back to your point about the emergency, Ms. Walsh, and Chief Judge Easterbrook's inquiry about having some flex for that emergency. Is it your position then there that at any time a spot cannot, let's say, three of the 100 spots can't remain open for the purposes of that emergency case? I mean, everybody we're talking about for this hypothetical is in the eligible for the waiver program. But one of them develops these extraordinary needs, you know, the overnight phenomena. Is it your position that there can't be room, because everyone isn't being served, obviously, on a 100-person facility, if even with a 10,000-person population? So I'm asking you, if the state reserves any room, let's say 3 to 5%, 3 to 5 beds, whatever, that would be inappropriate.
Well, that they haven't, as far as I'm aware of. If they did,
would they be permitted?
CMS may approve that. That's a legitimate concern that there could be some reserve capacity, but CMS has made it clear that if someone is in the program, they cannot be denied a needed service which is offered in the program. So if a person is in the program and they're not in an emergency and there's other people, those persons will agree, have no problem waiting as long as they get the funding with reasonable promptness. If there's no other further questions, I'll save my time for rebuttal.
And Mr. Farley. Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the defendant officials. This is a case about supply and demand. After you get over the mootness problem, there is a plaintiff here still, Mr. Patterson, but Mr. Bertrand's case is moot, and that's why he has no standing to appeal. And that's...
Well, I don't even know the concept of standing to appeal. If the case is moot, it's just moot. There's no case or controversy. But let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Farley. Are there any cases out there in which the Indianapolis against Jacobs principle has been applied even when no class was ever certified?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. And in fact, in the cases...
When you say not to your knowledge, is that because you've looked and didn't find any, or because you didn't look?
That's because I looked, Your Honor. And the cases that we cite, both Gates and Culver, stand for the proposition that once a particular named plaintiff there can't be any relief for him, and here Mr. Bertrand already has the relief he would have wanted in the case. Once that happens, there's both a presumption that this person is not an adequate class representative, and it's time for a new person to come in who has...
Your current answer suggests that you maybe haven't gotten my question, because there are no class representatives in this case. There is no class.
Correct.
Right? Indianapolis against Jacobs holds that if there is a class and the claim by a given person becomes moot, he can continue serving as class representative.
Correct.
But here there's no class. I'm just trying to figure out whether the Jacobs principle has been extended to cases where a class was asked for but never certified.
No, Your Honor, because in both Gates and Culver indicate that the Jacobs principle would not extend if the case has not gone to, has not, the class has not been certified. The problem with plaintiffs, with Mr. Patterson's claim, is that, again, it's a case of supply and demand. There are simply not enough CELA placements available, even for everybody who is urgent, much less for people who are not, like Mr. Patterson. And how do we know this?
Now I'm confused. The plaintiff says, Patterson says, and I hadn't understood you to deny, that there are unused slots in this program. There's a cap on the number of slots, and some are unused.
That's correct.
Okay, so when you say there aren't enough places, that seems odd, because there are unused slots. Now, it could be that there are unused places because Illinois isn't fulfilling the promise it made to HHS in order to get this waiver. That appears to be the plaintiff's theory. And the other reason is that there are unused slots because it's a sensible administrative device to hold some unused slots to make sure there's one available when somebody who's in real need of services appears. One of these would be a violation of the Act, and one of these would be, you know, one might think, a sensible way to administer the rule. How can we tell which of these HHS thinks is true and whether it's really approved what Illinois is doing?
Well, Your Honor, we know from the record, and it's undisputed, that HHS was told about the waiver, about the priority criteria, that the priority criteria in particular were discussed, and that the plan was approved.
The question is, was HHS told, and therefore implicitly, did it approve the use of the priority criteria to hold slots open, or did it approve them as a form of a triage device to apportion new positions as they became open?
Your Honor, I think both are true. Let me go back to explain. There are two aspects to this. There's the waiver program as a whole, in which there are 12,000 slots. One of the services that is funded under the waiver program is the CELA, the community placement program. The problem is that even though there are 12,000 waiver program slots, there are far fewer providers who have the number of providers for this particular service is small. The number of placement opportunities is very small, and it is smaller than the urgent population. And we know that because Mr. Bertrand, even when he satisfied the priority criteria, could not be placed immediately in a CELA. He had to wait because the CELA slots are a much smaller number than the program slots. Even if the department were to give Mr. Patterson money for CELA services, he couldn't use it because all the CELA service providers are full with emergency people, with urgency people. That's the problem. Plaintiff equates a waiver program slot, one of the 12,000 slots, with the CELA slots. And that's just not true. This is like a kidney transplant. Medicaid would pay for a kidney transplant. But just because your doctor says you need a kidney transplant doesn't mean you get one the next day. The problem is that there's a limit. This is a very, very scarce resource, just like any transplant. And so Mr. Patterson is receiving other services under the waiver program, just as one would receive dialysis from through Medicaid. But you just can't, just because you're eligible, and this is the principle behind Tommaso, just because you're eligible for something, to be president, for a work release program, for CELA services, doesn't mean you have an absolute right to that. And that's what the priority criteria were designed to do. The priority criteria are the way to satisfy the reasonable promptness requirement for everybody, for the pool of people who is in need of CELA services. There are far more people who need CELA services than providers have available beds for them. It is not a matter of our refusing to fund it. It's a matter of there not being any Scylla beds available to be funded by us. But the more important question...
Explain to HHS?
I believe so. I mean, the record doesn't say that it wasn't. I mean, that's the purpose of the priority criteria.
You know, much of this drives me back to the question why we shouldn't be insisting that this be conducted under the APA, where the right defendant is HHS, and we review the administrative record.
I completely agree, Your Honor.
Trying to speculate about what HHS knew or did or thought.
I completely agree, Your Honor. This case, there is not, under the Gonzaga City of Rancho Perlas Vedas criteria, this case does not belong. This case, the plaintiff versus Illinois case, simply doesn't belong in federal court. There's what the plaintiff really should do.
It certainly belongs in federal court. Okay. The question is whether it belongs in federal court with you as the defendant.
That's what I'm.
Or with the Secretary of HHS as the defendant.
Right. That's right. The plaintiff versus Illinois case doesn't belong in federal court. This would be, in fact, the right case. This is exactly what the plaintiff had done, because really this is, as the court suggested, a collateral attack on HHS's approval of the plan. And if HHS, or on our enforcement of that plan, and if the plaintiff has a problem with either HHS's approval of the plan or our enforcement of the plan, the where he should go is to HHS, because HHS can either withdraw or limit our funds, which is the proper remedy for a spending clause statute violation. What happens is, you know, the plan is our agreement with the feds to fund certain services under certain conditions. And we agree to those conditions, like reasonable promptness, like a fair hearing for denial of reasonable promptness. And what the plaintiff's real complaint here is that either the HHS should not have approved it because the priority criteria completely exclude, as a matter of our decision versus a matter of supply and demand of a particular service, or that HHS is now not enforcing the plan that it approved. What plaintiff's case against us would be the subject of a fair hearing, which the plan provides for and plaintiff never asked for. We have to, under Medicaid law, we have to agree to provide fair hearings for reasonable promptness questions. And plaintiff never asked for this. He just filed this suit. In addition, our fair hearing is for denial of service within the waiver program. Plaintiff could have asked for that fair hearing, and he did not. So there are many, many other more proper remedies.
Wait, does Illinois offer unfair hearings too?
I hope not, Your Honor.
You have to ask separately for a fair hearing as opposed to asking for a hearing?
I surely hope not, Your Honor. I believe they're not available. I hope they're not available.
There might be slots available in the separate unfair hearing.
I believe not, but I don't know. And, you know, at bottom, plaintiff agrees with that if there's an urgently needed, if a developmentally disabled person urgently needs Scylla services, that person needs to go to the front of the queue before plaintiff does. And the problem is that from this record, there is not any evidence that there is ever a slot that is not filled with a person with urgent needs. It's not a matter of funding, it's a matter of Scylla availability. And this is part of the waiver program. Remember, the freedom of choice is to choose between the available services and services in a facility. It's not to choose, and this is a fundamental Medicaid tenet, that Medicaid does not grant you a right to a service designed for your particular needs. That's Alexander. Medicaid is there to provide you, and certainly through the waiver program, the services that are available. If they're not available, there's no vacancy. I mean, there's just, and so this is under plaintiff's own authorities, under Macon, under Bryson. There isn't, that what the plaintiff wants simply is not available. And if it's not available, even if there were a 1983 cause of action here, there would not be a violation of either the reasonable promptness requirement or of the ability to choose to be informed of the available services as an alternate to facility-based care, and then to choose that available alternative. If there are no further questions, we ask that the court first find that Mr. Bertrand's case is now moot and dismiss him from the case, and also to affirm the judgment either on the lack of jurisdiction under 19 or the lack of a cause of action under 1983 or on the merits. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Farley?
The state is completely wrong when they say it's not a matter of funding and it's a supply and demand. Plaintiff Patterson identified a provider, Oak Leiden, that was willing to serve him, and they had a vacancy, and they denied him funding. The state talks about 12,000 people being served in the waiver, but they keep a cap, a de facto cap, of around funding SILAs in the amount of about $6,500, $6,250. It is a matter of funding. The SILAs are provided by private agencies, not for profits, and some for profits. So it's a supply and demand. Someone is not going to open up a group home or an apartment for a person unless there's funding. Because if you have a vacancy, you have no money coming in and you have costs. The issue is precisely a funding. They will not fund people. Because if they would have funded Patterson, he would have had a provider that was all lined up, and that was it. And even Bertrand had a provider lined up, and they initially turned him down because he didn't satisfy. So the state is putting this de facto cap, you know, of we're only going to fund because we want to control our costs. And we're only going to fund around 6,500 SILAs, tough, even if somebody else is in the program and they have a need for that service. So there's no evidence that there aren't SILA providers who are willing to serve the people. The evidence is overwhelming that the state will not fund people unless they satisfy their criteria.
You say the evidence is overwhelming. What evidence was before HHS on this question? Coming back to my concern about reviewing the administrative record and so on.
The state never said that we're putting in service priority because we don't have suppliers. Again, I have no quarrel with what CMS approved.
I just don't understand what role priorities play unless there is limited capacity. Otherwise, there's no need for priorities. Right? The need for priorities is created by governmental intervention. Otherwise, you would just raise the price until the market cleared. So that's not happening. But why do you insert priorities at all without a concern about capacity constraints at the price?
As to why they inserted it, they just said that's the language we use with our contract providers. I don't know, because they don't say we're putting this in to limit or to exclude.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Farley. The case will be taken under advisement.